many alcoholic men and women in this room tonight, and listening later on nowtheclub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. And our speaker tonight is George, who I had the pleasure of meeting last week, and I'm really looking forward to hearing his story tonight. So now I give you George.
Thank you, Rachel. My name is George, and I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be here with y'all tonight. I have a tough act to follow. The speaker last week told one of the best AA stories I've heard in a long time. That was really good. So I don't know what I'm going to say, but I'm going to just try to be honest, because there are a couple of people in here that know me, so I got to be honest the best I can. I may try to tell the truth. I'm a little old, so you know, I can forget stuff and get away with some of this stuff. But you know, Tim is one of the latest in the people who messes up a good drunk, you see, because he happened to ask, I guess, about 2 months ago, you know, for me to do this. So, you know, I couldn't get drunk for the last 2 months, you know. I said, well, I got to tell my story, 29th, 28th of March, I can't get drunk. And that same process started somewhere around April 20th, 1986. And somebody at that time stopped that downward spiral. I was 33 years old. I was drunk. I had about $5 in my pocket, a pack of cigarettes, and a whole pack of cigarettes. And I was hanging out with a guy who had a shoebox full of money. We had been spending his money for about a week. Drunk, just drunk, just drunk, you know. And he said, well, man, why don't you go somewhere, you know, and get some rest and come back later on today and we'll start it up again. You know? So he went in the house and I had to go somewhere and I didn't know where to go. So he again, that process started. Somehow I wound up out at my mother's house. And she had long since taken the key and put me out, and for some strange reason the door just opened and she just let me in. You know, just drunk, 33, hopeless, no good, oldest son. And she didn't ask where I'd been or why was I there or why she should let me in. She just let me in. And I just went to sleep and rested up. And I'd been around the fellowship for a little while, and somebody called about 6 o'clock that afternoon. It was a Sunday afternoon. And they asked if I wanted to go to a meeting. And I said, no, I can't go to a meeting, you know. I'm just going to get some rest. And I got some rest. But the next night I went to an AA meeting down in the city here, down in on Boulevard, picked up a white chip. And I just remember sleeping a lot those next couple of days. And I had a few cigarettes left. I had a couple of cigarettes left in that pack. And by Thursday, I figured, well, I don't need these anymore. Got rid of those. So now the other drunks just messed up now, because somebody called and asked if I wanted to do some work. You know, and I hadn't worked in a long time. I guess during my drinking career, about 18 years, I worked about 4 years out of 18, you know, and that's a cumulative 4 months here, 6 months there, maybe a year, you know. So I say, I don't know. I'll come out there and check it out. So it was just a basic cleanup warehouse job, and so sure enough, I went out there and I worked about 4 hours, and that's about as best as I could give them. And they asked me if I could come back tomorrow. I said, I don't know. I'm going to need to get some rest. So sure enough, I got me some rest, and the day passed, and I went to a meeting, and then they called the next day, and they said, well, you think you can come back to work? And I said, well, yeah, I think I can come back. I can give you 4 more, maybe. And I went back and gave him 4 more. And that was pretty good. And they said, well, you think you can come back tomorrow? And I said, well, I don't know. I better get some rest, you know. And so I got some more rest. And by this time, I had picked a sponsor. This sponsor picked me, I guess, Willis. Willis W. Willis was a big dude, old, retired postal worker, tough guy. And he was going to give me a 24-hour book. And Willis kind of scared me, you know, because, you know, I'm just newly sober, you know, I'm still shaking, you know, and I don't know what this guy's going to do, what's he going to do, and I just know he is this, you know, this line stacking up now. He's messing up a good drunk, too, you know, because I got to call Willis and tell him what I'm doing and what I'm thinking. And Willis wants to buy me that 24-hour book, and, you know, somehow I got a little shy. You know, it's interesting when a drunk gets shy. And I went in the back of the room, and Willis said, George, come over here and get that book. You know, and so sure enough, I got to go up there and get the book. And, you know, and I got to call Willis every day, and Willis was real good to me. Willis was real patient to me. We started talking about that work thing, you know, and Willis was just kind of, he was walking with me on that work. And I said, Willis, I can't work for 4 hours. And he said, all right, just do the best you can. Just stay sober and do the best you can. So finally, I started working 8 hours a day, you know, and I called Willis about 5, 6, 7, 8 times a day sometimes because I didn't want to get drunk. I'm scared to death. You know, I'm working. I'm scared. So I call Willis, and he, you know, we talk, and I get through it and everything. And I work a little bit more, and I get kind of shaky and trembling. I call Willis, you know, and he get me through that day. And, you know, he said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to go home and take a shower, and I'll see you at the meeting. So sure enough, I did, you know, and I did that. And I guess this went on for about 2 months, maybe. And so finally, you know, you have to watch these AA people, you know, see, they'll get slick on you after a while, you know. So I called him about that second time one day, and he said, George, you got to get those people a good 8 hours for a change, you know. He said, just call me when you get off, you know. Oh, man, what do you mean I can't call him in the next hour, you know. And so sure enough, I got through that day, and I called him later on that day, and, you know, then, so that set in place my ability to start working. Because when I got here, I couldn't work. I mean, I was really hopeless and helpless. I've been drunk for 18 years, I've been lying, cheating, stealing, and that's why I was a surprise my mother let me in that day. She just didn't ask any questions, you know, maybe she just saw that, you know, he's my son, you know, I got to give him one more chance, you know. Now, of course, she didn't ask me, because, you know, if she had asked me, you know, are you going to stop drinking now? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, are you act right now? I don't know, you know. So maybe she just learned she didn't need to ask me that question. So I started getting sober. I started going to those meetings, and I started getting involved, and I started hearing people talk about they had been to where I had been, and they had felt as hopeless and helpless as I had. And they just said, George, just keep coming back. Just keep coming back. You know, and this was a nice job, because what it was just a cleanup job. You know, all I had to do was go in and clean up all the dust and stuff. It was a kitchen and bath cabinet company, and the cabinet doors were all over the place, and junk and dirt and all that stuff. And I just bit by bit, you know, started cleaning up the place. And they had a dump truck out on the dock. And then in the back of the dump truck, they said, well, just all that trash, just throw it out there in the back of the dump truck. So sure enough, I did, and they really liked the way I was working. And one day, I saw this guy going out, and he had the hood up on the truck. And he was changing the oil, and then he cranked it up one day. And then, you know, and you know, finally got to the point where I filled up the back of that dump truck. And he said, well, now you got to go haul this trash up to the dump and take it. And I had never driven a dump truck. But sure enough, you know, I put that baby and fired it up. And, you know, I think it had a maximum speed of about 35 miles per hour, you know. So I popped those gears and get that baby to the dump, and thank God it just had one button I had to push. Then it go back and all the trash fly out, you know, and then I'd hit that button again and come back down. I'd drive back over and pop that baby and do it again, you know. So, man, I was feeling really good. But like I say, another thing happens. See, like I say, it's hard to get drunk. People just have, they start watching you, and they start giving you responsibilities. So sure enough, it's about 6 guys on this job, and every morning somebody would go to Miss Winter's and buy breakfast for everybody. I mean, you'd have to chip in and everything. And so sure enough, somebody would go out and get breakfast every day. Well, my day came. And so they gave me, I think it was $26, and they threw me keys to a car. They said, well, you got to go up and get everybody breakfast, you know. So sure enough, I jumped in the car, and I started heading to Miss Winter's. And about halfway there, I started crying. I mean, the tears that I had to pull off, I couldn't drive because my eyes were all clouded and everything. And it dawned on me, this was the first time in a long time that somebody had given me a car and some money, and I was going to do the right thing, you know. And it was pretty overwhelming, you know. So I got through that, and that worked out pretty good, and you know, things worked out very well, and I moved on. You know, by this time I was getting a little bit responsible, and like I say, those feelings were coming up, and I'd get a little tearful every once in a while. And this friend of mine, Don had one of the biggest, best smiles that I ever know. And I come from a family of great smiles, but Don had this fabulous smile. And Don started talking about gratitude, and he talked about how he learned about gratitude from this old man who was down at camps, and he was in the program, and he was sober, and Don said he went to visit him one day, and he just had that big old smile on his face. He said, man, I'm just glad to be sober. You know, he was down at camps, you know. And I remembered that, but I still didn't quite know, you know, what gratitude really was. I didn't know what it really felt like. I really didn't know what it looked like. And part of my job at this warehouse was they had a leak in the roof back on the dock. And every time it rained, you know, the water would puddle up back there in the dock. And so after it started raining, I had to get that mop, you know, and mop up the puddle and squeeze it out and everything. And I remember one day I was cleaning up one of those puddles of water. And here again, those tears started coming down. You know, and it dawned on me, I was grateful to have a job. You know, I was grateful to have a job, and I was grateful to be sober. You know, and I said, oh, well, this is what this gratitude is about, they're talking about. Things moved on, and I remember sitting on a conveyor belt one morning. Oh, after we got everybody loaded up, and I remember thinking, I believe. And what I attached that to was, I believe I could stay on that job, you know, because like I said, this was new behavior, this work stuff. I'd heard about it and read about it, but you know, this was new behavior for me, you know, staying on a job. And I just remember repeating, I believe I can stay on this job. And then also, I believe I can stay sober today. You know, just like I've been hearing them talk about in the meetings. You know, just try it one day at a time. And I really believe that. You know, I really believe that. At about 9 months sober, a friend of mine had come to me and mentioned something. And not about another job, but he mentioned something about, George, there's another job out there for you when you are ready for it. And I just filed that back, you know, and I just kept doing what I was doing. And sure enough, at 1 year sober, this guy offered me a job at the warehouse where he worked. You know, and again, it was for a little bit more money and a little bit more responsibility. And I've just always remembered that, because that's the way things kind of work out for me around this program. Seems like I get the next assignment that I'm ready for, you know. And so I got that. And, you know, part of my story and part of what I had come to, you know, I'd always been a good reader in school and always done very well, but, you know, I hadn't been reading much. But one of the things Willis told me was, George, just read something out of the big book every day. You know, sentence, paragraph, page, if you can, but just read something out of the big book every day. So sure enough, I read something out of the big book every day. And it was about an 18-month sober. One of the guys who worked in his warehouse had a shelf full of softback books. And he said, man, you know, if you ever want a book, you know, yeah, just grab it, let me know what you got and read it, you know. And I was kind of, you know. And so finally, it was about 18 months sober. I asked him about this book, and it was The Second Deadly Sin by Lawrence Sanders. And I picked it up and started reading it, you know. And so sure enough, I got through that book, and I just remember how proud I felt, because I didn't think I'd be able to read the way I had been able to read before. I just thought, you know, I'd damaged myself so much from all those activities while I was drunk. And so sure enough, I read it. I've read it two other times since then. I love that book, and I've just been thinking about it lately. Get another copy of it and read it again. It's a great story. So things moved on, and everything just kind of rocked and rolled, and I got another job, and I remember this one guy who was a sales guy, and I remember I'd always been a jealous kind of a guy. You know, it seems like most of the people I ran around with always had a dollar more than I did, a little bit better job, a little bit better situation. This guy was a sales guy, pharmaceutical company. He had another drug of choice, and he was kind of a high roller. And he said, George, why don't you quit thinking about jobs? Why don't you start thinking about a career? You know, and again, this was kind of foreign to me, because, you know, even though I'd had some education and had come from a very educated family, you know, didn't think I, you know, career, you know, was a little bit beyond my ability to think about. But somehow, you know, some things started changing because I was sober. Because, you know, what I had thought about, if I could stay sober for the next 40 years, you know, and rent a room out, you know, maybe 20 by 20 perhaps, you know, I'd probably be a little bit ambitious for me. If I could stay sober for the next 40 years, get me a little room, my life would be complete, you know, and that's the way I felt, you know, based on where I come. If I could accomplish that, you know, my life would be a success. And so sure enough, and here, you know, one of the things about being around this program and staying around, things just happen. You know, you mind your own business. Here again, somebody messing up another drug. You know, I got laid off from a job, you know, and I'm applying for jobs, looking around, but I was married at the time. And so, you know, one of the things you start doing once you get sober is, you know, you get smart. And so my wife at the time had this Tupperware up under the kitchen sink, everything. And it just wasn't right. I mean, it just scattered all over the place. So sure enough, I fixed up the Tupperware and everything. She came over one day and said, I've got to get you a job. You know, because you're dangerous around this house by yourself. And so sure enough, through a friend of a friend, she had mentioned something about this situation. And I guess this is a long story. I guess I might as well tell a long version. If Franklin wasn't here, I wouldn't tell a long story. But since Franklin's here, Franklin probably needs to know the rest of the story, too. This was, and Risa, for that matter, it was, I lost the story. I had always wanted to work for Southern Bell. It was Southern Bell back then. Some of these young folks don't know. Ain't no Bell South. And it's gone now, too, you know. But I had always wanted to work for Southern Bell. And a good buddy of mine and I had gone to apply for a job at Southern Bell when we were in high school. You know, we were football players. We had played, you know, football together, done all that stuff, been drunk, you know, for a long time. And he passed the test, and I didn't. And I still can't figure that one out, you know, how he passed the test. You know, because I thought he drank way more than I did, you know. But anyway, he passed the test. He got the job. As a matter of fact, he retired from Southern Bell a few years ago. But anyway, you know, now that I'm sober, things are going well, and I'm applying for jobs. Well, I'm applying for your dream job. Well, you know, I still had, I don't want to say it's resentment, but I still wanted to work for Southern Bell. And so sure enough, I applied for Southern Bell. And so in the meantime, I had heard about this situation of at Peachwood Hospital. And I called up there, and the guy said, yeah, we want to start this counseling training program, but you've got to start off in housekeeping. I think it's like $6 an hour, you know. And like I said, I'm getting sober, and I'm getting smart now. I'm like, housekeeping. I don't know how to do that, you know. So I called Willis and I talked to a few other people and went to a meeting, and so sure enough, the next morning I woke up and it dawned on me, you know, it's like, you know, I think I better call them back. That might be a pretty good deal, you know. So the guy says, yeah, come on out. He said, really, we want you to start off in engineering for $8 an hour, you know. And so sure enough, I said, okay, I'll be out there at 2 o'clock. But by this time, and here again, somebody getting in the way of another good drunk. I go out to the mailbox, look in the mailbox, sure enough, a letter from Southern Bell. You know, he was offering me a clerical job. But I knew I was supposed to go to Southern Bell. So I went out there and all that stuff and got into this training program and got into substance abuse counseling. So the career was born. You know, career was born. And I was sober and things were going very well. A lot of things happen. You learn a lot. Met a lot of people, did a lot of stuff, and here again, just a lot of what we talk about, miracles started happening. You know, I stayed sober, I enjoyed this job, got certified, you know, worked with a lot of great people, you know, started doing a lot of traveling, all this stuff, and just started doing all the stuff that I wanted to do. Because I can remember when I got sober, I made this list of a few things that I wanted to do, things I had not been able to do because I've been drunk so long, you know. And I always wanted to be sober, I always wanted to be married, and I always want to have a job, you know. These things were coming true. The flyer said my sobriety date is April 12, 1995, but I don't consider that my sobriety date. That's the date of my last drink. You know, my sobriety date is April 20, 1986. And I'll tell you the difference, and Lisa may get a kick out of this story. I was going through a divorce from his first wife back in whenever the divorce had, I guess it was 95, I guess it was early 1995. And this guy was acting up in the hospital, you know, and they wanted me to escort him out of the hospital, right? So, like I said, I'm going through this divorce, I'm anxious, I'm running all over the place, you know, I'm crazy, still going to meetings, still talking to my sponsor, you know, still got the network happening, all this stuff. But they want me to escort this guy out of the hospital, you know. So sure enough, I escort the guy out of the hospital, get him out, you know, he's trying to act up. Well, the next morning, you know, I'm just nuts, you know, I'm just nuts, I can't get any relief, I'm just all over the place, I'm running around the house, I'm just going, I didn't go to work that day, but I'm calling my sponsor, calling all kind of folks and everything, and the idea of drinking a beer hit me, and I just remember, I calmed down, and I haven't done anything yet, but just something about the idea of drinking a beer hit me, and I just calmed down, and I can remember thinking, George, you know, you're in trouble, you know, if you're thinking about a beer, you better call somebody, and there have been, you know, doctors that I have worked with at the hospital and everything, and I'm going to use my one curse word, you know, and so the thought hit me, you know, to call one of the doctors out there that I felt comfortable with, so I'm saying, well, call Dr. Scott, you ought to call Dr. Scott, and I can remember thinking, fuck Dr. Scott. And so sure enough, you know, and here again, I'll just mention this and you can go with the rest of it, you know, drugs are a big part of my story. But you know, so you know, that happens, and so now I got to go get this beer. But you know, my truck downtown, so I got to go get my truck. And I've got a little bit too much money on my hand, and for some reason an income tax check had come and all this stuff, and I got in a cab. The cab took me home. I showered, put too much money in my pocket, went downtown, got my truck, and 3 minutes later I ran into an old friend of mine, you know, we used to do a lot of dope together, blah 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 blah, and I gave her, I don't know how much money, I said, go get me some drugs and blah 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 and all this stuff. So we down, where are we going to get the stuff? And I'm shaking just like this, because I still hadn't had that beer yet. You know, I'm just shaking like this, and so I'm saying, George, go, you know, you really let her keep the money. Just get the hell out of here. Two curse words. Just leave. Just go. And I get out the truck, and I start walking around. But guess who's standing on the corner? The guy who I escorted out of the hospital yesterday. And I'm kind of ducking, you know, because he's a big bag, peaceful counselor, you know. What he doing out here on the corner, right? You know. So there I am on the corner. I'm trying to hide from him. And they get the beer and everything, and I'm in the truck, and I'm in a police car. I'm running out the car. Cop car gets right by. I'm shaking. Got the beer, hand him over, I'm shaking like this, you know. Get out of there, go back out there where I live. And I still ain't drank the beer. Go home, pick mail out the box, got a bunch of mail, drop the mail, got the beer, got all this other stuff, you know. Just a madman, you know. So finally, you know, drank the beer and everything and just go crazy. So, you know, about 10 o'clock that night, I said, well, you know, you need to go get some more stuff, you know. So sure enough, I go head back down, and there the lady is, you know, I went to school with me, or whatever, you know. And same thing, you know, go get me some more stuff, blah, blah, blah. So this time I figured, you know, but you know, you're a good wino, you know, you need to get you some wine, you know. So sure enough, I got me a pint of wine, come up out the place, cop car again, right behind me, you know. So I got to get out of there, he done pulled me over. I get home, I got the bottle of wine, you know, trying to get the wine down, everything. I'm going to pass out, you know, pass out, you know. So next day at 9 o'clock, you know, good friend of mine calls me at 9 o'clock, and it was just like that. It was over. Just like that. 16-hour relapse. Just like that. It was gone. Yeah. Fortunately, they sent me the pizza. They sent me the treatment out of state. You know, now one of the things about substance abuse counselors, and here again, this was here again, whether it's God's grace, stroke of luck, or Dr. Scott making a good decision, you know, was put him on the nut unit. You know, don't put him on the alcohol and drug unit. He's a counselor. You go in there and try to run some stuff, put him on the nut unit. And so sure enough, they did, you know, and things worked out. And one of the things that happened during those 2 weeks was, you know, whatever else I needed to clear up, you know, from my history or whatever, I was able to do that, you know, because I had to listen and I had to dig deep, you know, and I had to clear up, you know, some stuff, and I did that, you know. So, you know, things, you know, rocked and rolled, and, you know, just, you know, right back into the meetings, you know, and here again, just a couple of little tidbits about work and a career. You know, I didn't know what they were going to do, but I just remember when I left that hospital, two things. George, you've got to stay clean and sober no matter what. You know, you can't repeat another one of those situations, you know. And I just made that commitment. I say, they may fire me, they may not want me to work here anymore, but I've got to stay clean and sober. You know, so sure enough, went back and, you know, kind of pilled around there, and they're doing a few things, and then finally I got back into doing what I was doing. And so here we are today. A couple of things I mentioned. You know, one of the things that I really love about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we get a chance to love each other. Period. Because we've been there and done that, you know. Hips looking cool, we don't care, you know. Depressed, you know, feeling bad, you know, tricking, scheming, lying, cheating. We know that. We can do that too, you know. Just come on here, but just don't drink. Just don't drink, you know. Because see, we need you. See, we need you. That's what people told me. They say, George, stick around. We need you. You know, it's been a long time since people really needed me, you know. So stick around. And, you know, somebody, you know, could call me on my stuff when that needed to happen. You know, I could just do the best I can. One thing about my wife, like I said, I mentioned her story last week, and it was a great story. I mean, it was just smooth. It was the deal. And I don't need to blow up her ego or anything, but I just really got so much out of your message last Monday night. You know, I almost forgot you were drunk. You know, it's so good. But one of the things that being in this program and also being married in this program affords us is a different kind of teamwork. It's just a different kind of teamwork. And Deborah and I have been having a lot of family stuff, you know, a couple of deaths on my side. We had to move her mother in with us, and a lot of changes went on this fall. And through some of the work I do, you know, as a counselor, you know, I get these different assignments, and Deborah is just saying, well, you know, we need to get out of town for a while. We just need to go out to the beach, you know, and just kind of hang out a little bit, you know. And then usually, you know, she had had a history before I met her going to St. Simon's a lot, and we've been down to St. Simon's with the Hilton a couple of years ago. Maybe we just need to go down there for a couple of days and, you know, just hang out, just kind of, you know, rest and relaxation, you know, and all that stuff. Well, you know, you have to be careful in this program, you know. So the very next day, you know, some people I do some federal work for call. They say, well, we got this assignment, some work that you're good at, and, well, we want you to go to Honolulu, you know. So sure enough, you know, we went to Honolulu, you know. So we got the beach thing, you know. And it wasn't the beach we expected, but, you know, we got that. And, you know, fortunately, we went to meetings out there at Waikiki Beach every morning and in the afternoon, actually. So, you know, here again, another reason I can't get drunk. You know what I'm saying? Just too many good things just keep happening. All right, so let's go down the steps. Step one, what's it say up there? We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Well, you know, I had to admit complete defeat, just like the literature said, complete. George, you cannot drink that stuff, you know, period. You know, you just can't do that, you know. And I can remember as time went on, I remember it felt like I was levitating in the room. It was like I couldn't grab onto the ceiling, you know, and hold on, couldn't touch the walls, feet didn't hit the floor, but somehow I was staying sober. You know, and that's the first step, you know, it felt like to me, you know, just somehow I'm just levitating. I just make that decision not to drink, and things just kind of go where they go. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, I already talked about that, came to. And Joanne P., out of Boston, Joanne's dead now, but I remember Joanne, and some of y'all have heard that little thing, I came to believe. So, you know, you do the process however you want to, but, you know, if you stick around here long enough, you will believe, you see. You will believe. Because you will start getting a little bit sober, and you will get a little sane, and you'll understand what the insanity is about individually. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I had come from a family that, you know, was very religious in certain aspects. My grandfather was a very religious man, a good man. People loved my granddaddy. He had done a lot of good work in his field of endeavor, but also he was a good church man, you know. And I can remember sitting around before church sometime, and those deacons would say those prayers, and, man, you could just feel the whole room just kind of shaking, you know. And I just remember looking in there, and it was like, I don't know what they have, and I don't think I have that. You know, a friend of mine introduced me to this guy who was a philosopher. He said he was a philosopher. He wasn't a trained philosopher, but he had these books and sounded good. So philosopher, you know. And so somebody said, well, don't talk to the philosopher, you know. So sure enough, we meet every week, you know, we talk about this, that, and the other. Now he's in my wheelhouse now, you know, because, you know, one of the things a drunk like to do, you know, is sound smart and talk about all this esoteric stuff, you know, and just kind of drift off in the ozone. And so one day he asked me, he said, George, are you angry with God? You know, I said, no, you know, I'm not angry with God. And he kind of just left, and then we came back to it. He said, man, you angry with God? He said, you angry with God? And I said, you know. Well, you know, two things about that. And, you know, when I thought about God, I thought about my granddaddy, you know, because he was a good man, a decent man. And that's what, you know, any idea or notion I had about God would be decent and good like my granddaddy. And so why would I be angry with my granddaddy? He was just a good, decent man, you know, and helped people, and people loved him and all that stuff. And then one day the philosopher asked me, was I angry with God? I said, yeah, I'm angry with God. Yeah, I really am angry with God. Because I said, you know, there are about four things, you know, that happened in my life. And if God was really a good God, those four things wouldn't have happened. And one of the benefits of getting honest about that and really getting angry, you know, now I can have a relationship with God. You know, I can develop a sense of God that I can understand. I can develop a relationship with this God. And the relationship was this God loved me, cared for me, and wanted the best for me. And that's sort of how I got into step three, in developing a God of my understanding. Step four made us searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. But one of the things about my drinking, you know, I guess I had a lot of blackouts, you know, but I remembered a lot of stuff, you see. So, you know, I could pull up what I needed to pull up, you know, but there are a few things that, you know, that I didn't know about or wasn't sure about it. And through, you know, working with this one sponsor in particular, and I tried that four step and I had an experience that some people had. Trying that four step, and for whatever reason you get drunk again, you know, and I've done that. Tried the four step, get drunk. Tried the four step, get drunk. Right? But this time, you know, I can remember, and this is what it felt like. Now, again, in point of fact, it didn't happen this way, but I just remember, you know, that sheet of paper. Now, I had written a lot of stuff on a lot of different paper sheets of paper, but I had just this one sheet of paper, and it just felt like I was climbing out of the ocean, and I was trying to keep this piece of paper dry, and I got this out of here. And we talked about that, you know. And for some reason, I was able to clear up. You know, I was able to make that fearless moral inventory. You know, step five was a good day, you know, because I could get honest. You know, I could get honest. But there were about two things that, you know, God, I think, you know, I think me and you just need to hold on to these two things. And it was about 5 years sober. And some of y'all went to the Rock this weekend, some of the guys. And we had come from the Rock, and we went up to the monastery up there in Condors. And now we were sitting out by the lake, you know, the birds flying around, chirping, and the sun's out, it's warm and nice. That spring, and I'm, you know, with the guy that I butted up with, felt comfortable with. And for some reason, those last two things just kind of slipped out. You know, we were talking, and just slipped out, you know. And what I remember about that experience was the energy release, you know. Because it takes a lot of energy to, you know, Judy's right there, don't say, don't say, you know. Now it's gone. See, I don't have to hold it in, you see. So I'm free. I'm free. Hey, boy, that felt good, you know, to get that stuff out. You know, step six, now, I'm a little slow sometimes. But I remember it was in the 9:30 meeting, and Eric, I remember when you started coming to the 9:30 meeting. I saw you last week. I said, what's the guy's name right there? I said, well, the reason I used to remember was his name is the same as my brother's name. But it was in that 9:30 meeting over there one morning. I was about 4 years sober, so and I remember thinking, hey, man, that thing says, God removed all these defects of character. Not me. You know, I thought I was supposed to dig all that stuff out of the movies. This is God. And so sure enough, you know, I had some work to do. Again, step by step, bit by bit, slowly over time, one day at a time, these things started decreasing in their power and their strength, you see. I just don't have those defects the way I used to. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, you know. God, I want to stay sober more than anything else in my life. You know, please help me. Please help me. So that became my prayer. God, please help me. I do not want to get drunk. Please help me. And however I need to work on these character defects, my shortcomings, please put me in a position to do it. You know, I'm willing to do what I need to do. I want to be a good man, a decent man. I'm around a lot of good people, people who love me and care for me and help me, you know, be worthy somehow, you know, of all the wonderful gifts you give me. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. You know, the list was pretty easy. I remember all that stuff. You know, again, I remember writing that list down and putting those people down. The story I like to tell, I guess a couple of stories. One was Cooper Drugstore down on Sumpson. It used to be Sumpson Street. I busted a $100 check, bad check, of course. And so I got sober, and of course, they were on the list. You know, and I remember going by there and I said, Mr. Cooper, I busted a bad check here about 10 years ago, and I owe you $100. I don't have a whole $100, but I give you $10 now, and every week when I get paid, I'm going to come give you $10, and then I paid $100. And I think I got up to about 8, and he said, sir, he said, you do not have to bring me those last $20. He said, I've never seen anything like it. You know, he said, man, I'm just really amazed that, you know, you really did this. And I did that. Now, the one that was most special was Miss Brown. Miss Brown lived 3 doors down from where I grew up. And you know, one of the things about my alcoholic brain, Miss Brown called out to me one day, and she had this letter, this card she wanted me to go take to the mailbox, you know, right up the street. At this time, the mailbox was in the neighborhood. And she said, well, take this up to the mailbox for me. Now, you know, my alcoholic brain knows, A, it's a card, B, the address is to the church, C, there's cash in this envelope, you know. So sure enough, I open up that cash, that envelope, and get those $15 out there and go get drunk, you know. So now I got to come back and tell them, you know. And when I told my sponsor we were going over the list, he said, well, you're going to have to take up $30, you know. You have to double up on this one, you know. And boy, you talk about a long walk up a sidewalk. Man, it's a long walk up there, man. You know, she had known me from, you know, all here. I'd walk up there. And she said, well, thank you. She said, I just knew something was wrong with you. That's right. So we got the 8-9 out the way. Yeah. Step 10, I remember when I came in, I remember reading step 10 to 12 and 12, and I just remember it says, and asked that famous question, can we stay sober, keep an emotional balance, and live to good purpose under any and all conditions? And I remember when I read that, I remember thinking, you know, that's what I want. Because, you know, I've been a wreck out there. You know, I didn't have that emotional balance. You know, I wasn't living to good purpose, you know, but I just remember thinking, that's what I want. Step 11 is pretty smooth, and I think about a good friend of mine, you know, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our consciousness. Contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Some of y'all may know, I'm not going to tell her whole name, I'll say her name is her name. But I can remember couple of things. I'd grown up in the wild with her brothers. I knew her husband from the streets and all that jazz, blah, 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 blah. But Wendy was just out there, you know, doing a little bit too much stuff, and I'm a madman sitting on the edge of the woods doing my thing. And she drives up in this little Toyota, and she's got those two little kids back in the back of the car, and I just remember thinking for some reason, Lord, please help that child, you know, and I don't know where that came from. And sure enough, so she got sober right after that, you know. And so she got sober for me, and when I remember when I came in, I remember when Wendy talked to us, I told her certain thing. I remember her talking about step 11. And she said what happened was she got sober, of course, and she was overwhelmed with just, you know, getting up every day, getting herself cleaned up, you know, coming to the meetings, you know, and getting the kids all fed, you know, to school or whatever, you know, the laundry stacking up, you know, the dishes in the doggone sink and everything. And she prayed about that and talked to her sponsor about that. And she used step 11. You know, to one day she got to that sink and she cleared all the stuff out the sink. One day she started knocking down that laundry and everything. And I just always remember that, because what that said to me was, I just do it a little bit at a time. You know, I don't have to have a whole Megillah. If I just seek through prayer and meditation, you know, as best I can, you know, and just do the best I can and try to do God's will as best, you know, I understand, A, my God, but also what's next and right for me. Step 12, we got to give it away. We got to give it away. So now I can talk about Franklin. It's good to see you here, you know. We go back a long way, you know. It's good to see you here. You know, one of the things that I loved about working at Peachwood was I got a chance to spend a lot of time with a lot of people, you know, a lot of bad places. And I loved being there, I mean, especially when I worked in the evenings. I just loved, you know, because I had something, you know, that was working in my life. You know, and I had some information that people was, that were sharing that was working in their life. And I wanted to be able to give that away. You know, I wanted to give that away. And so I got a chance to do that. And of course, you know, coming to the meetings on a regular basis, how we share back and forth and all that stuff. It's pretty remarkable. I don't know what it's like today. Deborah and I are just kind of tickling each other, smiling at each other, trying to figure out what's next. You know, here again, messed up another good drunk. You know, don't go to Honolulu. That's all I'm saying. You know, if you go to Honolulu, once you get back, that's all you can think about is, how can I get back? And so here again, it's just like, you know, we talk about around here, be careful what you pray for. Just be careful. Yeah, you may get it. You know, because Honolulu was definitely not on my list, as well as a lot of other things. Well, not on my list. You know, this is a wonderful program. You know, whether you're new or whether you've been around a while. You know, I used to say these kind of things. I don't say them anymore, but I'm going to say them tonight. You know, A, you know, I feel like one of the luckiest men in the world. You know, I really do. You know, based on where I came from that April 20th, 1986. You know, I was in a low place, doing a lot of low things, running around with a lot of low people. You know, they say the high cost of low living, it was real high, very painful. You know, and I don't have to live that way. And all they did was just, you know, George, just take it one day at a time. Just do the best you can. Just do the best you can one day at a time. The other thing is learning, you know, AA, you know, we talk a lot about this stuff, and, you know, you don't have to go to therapy, you know, unless you want to, or read those self-help books. You know, most of us have read at least 10 of those self-help books, and then we put them on the shelf, and then we try to just live, you know. But, you know, being in a relationship with yourself, you know, where you just kind of feel good about who you are, what you're doing, you're able to just look at the whole picture, you know, and just say, this is really who I am, you know. And say, you know what, I love who I am. Yeah. And then also being in a relationship with another, you know, and that to be satisfactory, you know, and helpful and peaceful, you know, where you all really are helping each other to grow and learn and live. It's pretty special. You know, life is good. You know, I love this program, and as it's talked about a lot, you know, it's just something real special about this room, you know. And so here again, if you've just started coming, you're probably getting some of the vibes, and of course, keep coming. This NAPA clubhouse in this particular room, you know, it's just a magic. I guess some just bouncing off of the brick wall, the brick over there on the walls, and of course, we have the windows right here, and plants. They used to have big royal plants all down there, and, you know, you just feel the oxygen in there, you know, to just keep you healthy. So I don't know, you know, stay around, because see, I'm getting older now, and I need you more now than I needed you, you know, when I was younger. See, I can't move as fast as I can, and sometimes I have to get a few words and everything, so I need some of you young folk to hang around, help me out, you know. But I'm an alcoholic who's very grateful, and Tim, thank you very much for keeping me sober one day. Thank y'all very much.
Thank you, George. That was really great. Okay, so we're going to pass the baskets again for anybody who came in late. And let's see. I've asked Leela to give out the chips.
I'm Leela, and I'm an alcoholic. Here at NAVA, we have a chip system to mark our time and sobriety. And if you would like to not drink 24 hours at a time, we'll leave this up here and come up and pick it up after. 30 days, silver. Ninety days. Red. Mm-hmm. 6 months. Yellow. 9 months. Green. And a year of multiples. Blue. And again, we offer you white chip if you'd like to not drink. One day at a time. We're not drinking one day at a time.
Yes. Surrender to it, right?
Yes.
Surrender.
Thank God for the chips you hold.
Time for any of any AA or NAVA club announcements. Okay, I've got one. Saturday, April 16th, 9:30 to midnight is a spring dance. Music from DJ Tony, $5 for singles, $8 for couples. And I would like to remind everybody that anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personality. Those who will please join us for the Lord's Prayer. Thank you.
Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Yeah, they're...